now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wisencroft, and today, Manchester United are stunned at home by one of the worst sides in Premier League history. The less said about that, the better. Elsewhere, Chelsea welcome Thomas Tuchel, and it's clear there's going to be some big changes on the way at Stamford Bridge. Sean Dyche survives on a bag of chips at Burnley. And will the wonder kid Martin Ødegaard work his magic at Arsenal? Yeah, I've pronounced it right. That's what he says. He's been telling us all how to pronounce his name. Although he did say Ødegaard will do. So maybe you can call him either. I don't know. To help me through it all and maybe decide on what we call Martin Ødegaard, Gregor Robertson, Tom Clark and Tom Roddy. How are you doing, guys?
Very well, Hugh.
Very well, Hugh.
I'm enjoying your, you know, teaching lesson to start the podcast. You know, the old adage, you learn something new every day. Can I have that again? Ødegaard, is it?
Ødegaard. I mean, it sounds, it's pretty good. Yeah, it sounds like some sort of fairground ride, but it works. It's got that pace to it. It rhymes. It's perfect. It's perfect. I'm in a great mood today. My dad is about half an hour away from his first jab of the vaccine, which for me is it's a stirring day. You know, an 80-year-old man, pretty much almost there. You know, he's had cancer, prostates, get him checked, guys. And yeah, so he's on the list and he's getting it done. And I didn't think I'd be as elated about it as I am. So
I'm the same view. My mum's getting it on Tuesday. Very happy to see that letter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, good feeling. And to those of you out there who have had it or who have family members about to have it, I'm sure you'll join in with us. We're getting there, people. We're getting there together. And we start today's podcast discussing Manchester United. Despite being second in the Premier League, they're not immune to criticism. See what I've done there? Anyway, the shock of the season as Sheffield United got just their second win of the campaign and their first victory at Old Trafford since 1973. It was a major off night for Manchester United and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side. But Gregor, all credit really should go to Sheffield United.
I mean, absolutely. It was kind of one of those, I think Phil Jagielka summed up afterwards where he was saying that, you know, so many players had fallen, you know, were out with injury. Felt like literally everything was against them. They had one win, going to a resurgent Man United, top of the league. And the team basically picked itself, he said. It was, apart from the strikers, the rest of the team, there was not any other options. And sometimes that can be quite liberating. It's like everything seems to get to be against us. And they go out there and they were just magnificent. I thought Jagielka as well was incredible. Everything that he kind of threw his body in front of, it hit him. It was one of those nights. There was one near the end, I think it was Fernandes got inside and he kind of threw his body flat on the floor and it hit his toe and went out. It was just like, it was one of those days for him and he was magnificent. And yeah, it was just kind of a bit more like what Sheffield United, we knew of them from last season in that they were organised and committed. And I think Chris Wilder was right too in that there've been very fine margins for almost all their games through the season. And on this occasion, you know, they got the deflection for the goal and, you know, the luck went with them a little bit and they thoroughly deserved the 3 points, I thought.
Yeah, I think 11 of the 15 games they've lost by a single goal. So it has been very fine margins for them. And it was great to hear Phil Jagielka talking after the game as well, saying even at the age of 38, the first person I called when I knew I was starting was my dad, who told me, as they both knew it would be his last game at Old Trafford, just enjoy it, son, which I thought was nice story.
After laughing, I thought it was quite funny as well. Yeah. Good luck, son.
Yeah, exactly. He did sort of say that as well. But look, his son's had a pretty decent career, hasn't he? So he deserved a special night at Old Trafford. It was a major off night, as I say, but Chris Wilder said in the build-up to the game that for his side, something extraordinary could happen this season, and I wondered whether last night could be the night to start things off for them, and actually it turned out to be in many ways. 10 points from safety still, though, Tom Roddy. Do you believe that Sheffield United could get themselves out of this?
I do, this season of all seasons. And I just think it's felt like this is coming. I mean, I was talking to Paul Hurst, our Manchester reporter, before the game last night when he was travelling over. And it's not, it wasn't a foregone conclusion, which tells you everything you need to know about Man United. But it also tells you what you need to know about Sheffield United. Because, as you said, Hugh, it's not like they've been battered every single week. There have been a few occasions, I think Palace maybe it happened, where they were really under par. But they've always been in every single game, and they're not Derby of 2008 or Sunderland of 2006 or Huddersfield of a couple of years ago. They've been really impressive, and I felt sorry for them that they looked like they were heading towards that terrible Premier League record. But I think what's interesting as well is maybe the FA Cup has helped them a little bit, you know, because they got the win before the Newcastle game, and then I think it was Plymouth, was it, who they beat in the last round before this game. And you speak to clubs like Wickham, and I think the ownership wanted to focus more on the league rather than the cup. But there was this idea in the team that a cup run could really help them in terms of relegation, in gaining momentum. Beating a team like Tottenham could provide a bit of belief going into the league. And it seems like that's what's happened with Sheffield United. And they've got City on Saturday, and I mean, that's a hard ask, but it does feel like something could happen this year. They've got it in that squad.
I think they've shown enough, though, even in the game against Manchester United. I know that's a game that many people saw as a free hit for them, but if they play like that against most of the other teams in the league, you think they might well have a chance. What they've lacked are goals, and I was surprised to see McGoldrick and Sharp starting up front. I mentioned, you know, it's a very experienced front line, let's call it that. But strangely, they were the ones breaking in behind the defence. They were the ones, you know, just teasing the offside trap, not the likes of Rashford and Martial and Greenwood at the other end of the pitch. It was a great performance from Sheffield United, but Manchester United was so disappointing as well, and that has played into the result too. They made 6 changes, Tom Clark. The likes of Martial, who I just mentioned, Matic, Telles, Tuanzebe, all started, and it was dire at times from them.
It was really poor, and I think Tom makes a good point about talking with Paul Hurst. There's a few Manchester United fans that I was speaking to last night, and they said similar. You know, they felt that this performance had been coming a little bit. And I have to say, I do slightly agree. Obviously, listeners will be wary of me launching into an anti-Solskjaer chat here, but which is not what I'm trying to do. But I have felt like United have looked a bit tired. They've, in the flip side to what we were saying about Sheffield United, losing a lot of games by one goal and it not quite going for them. And since the Leeds game, particularly in the league, Manchester United have won a lot of games by one goal and things have gone for them. You know, Paul Pogba has hit a vein of form which has helped to negate the fact that Bruno Fernandes' form has dipped slightly, I think, we have to be honest. Absolutely a brilliant player. Yes, he scored a brilliant free kick against Liverpool in the FA Cup. But I just think they have dipped slightly, and I think those changes were a little bit complacent from Solskjaer, I have to say. Particularly the choice to start Martial instead of Cavani. Cavani has been excellent in the last few games, and Martial looks completely devoid of any confidence. He's still pursuing this idea of him being a central striker, which he just isn't. He wants to play off the left, which is unfortunately for him where Marcus Rashford is best. And against the Sheffield United side, Cavani would have been perfect. You know, Phil Jagielka did have an excellent game, but somewhat of a Cavani's experience and work rate as well. Let's be honest, we've read a lot this week about how his work rate has impressed Solskjaer. Pulling those central defenders out of position, creating space, you watch that game, and there were so many. It's the classic thing with Manchester United. Martial and Rashford end up standing next to each other and things in that kind of pocket of space in front of an opposition defence. And then Martial almost goes, oh, crap, I'm not meant to be here, am I? Sorry, wait a minute, lads. I'll just go and get where I'm supposed to be in a central area making some runs. And it smacked of a little bit of complacency from Solskjaer. And in this season, when you would imagine both the title race and places in the top four, it's going to be very tight. It might come down to these fine margins. And I mean, I am desperate to hear Gregor's view on the defending for that winning goal for Sheffield United. Because I genuinely don't think it's extreme of me to say, as a fan of the Football League, that I've seen better defending in League Two than that goal for Manchester United. I mean, what on earth they were doing, I've no idea. Sheffield United, you could tell they had the ball, and it only when it finally got back to Ollie Burke and he thought, right, sod this, if they're not going to tackle me, I'm going to have a shot. Sheffield United were almost playing to just keep the ball. It was mental. Absolutely mental. I've never seen anything like it in the Premier League.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it matters what level you're playing at or watching football. If someone doesn't show the kind of willingness to close down the opponent, then it's not defending, essentially. It all looked like kind of pretend defending. You know, they were all like arms behind their backs, kind of shuffling out towards, just like looking like you're doing your job. But there was about five players doing the same within, like, I don't know, a 40-yard square area. And Sheffield United just kept, the ball just kept coming back to them, and they were like, well, we've got another chance. And then it was bizarre. It did look kind of, you know, everyone, it's easy to say they looked tired there, but it was more than that. I think they were kind of, as you say, it seemed to be a bit of complacency, and Man United had been knocking at the door for so long. Even a little break up the pitch, it didn't look like Sheffield United really had the kind of guile to open them up or to beat them down. And I suppose there was a little bit of luck in that, you know, there was a half clearance and then Burke got a second chance. But how many chances did they have to give them before someone closed them down? And, you know, some of the analysis after the game was about focusing a bit on, you know, Martial not tracking back. But for me, it was Pogba and Fernandes who were kind of standing in the vicinity doing nothing. And then also the defender, I think it's Twanzebe, was it, just not coming out to the ball. He was standing on the 6-yard box. And
Tellez was there as well, didn't close it down, had his arms behind his back, even though he was standing 5 yards wide of the post. It was incredible.
Matic did the same.
Hugh, you must have been screaming at the TV, surely.
Pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. Firstly, Harry Maguire plays a 2-yard ball back to his goalkeeper with his back to the rest of the play instead of just knocking it off for a corner. De Gea then passes it out to a Sheffield United player instead of just knocking it off for a corner. Tellez doesn't close the player down. Pogba doesn't close the player down. Martial is walking even though he's 6 yards away from the ball. Ollie Burke is standing 10 yards away from the goal, controls it, suddenly realises that no one's going to close him down, so he might as well just swing his right boot at it. And it gets deflected off Twanzebe in off the crossbar. And Twanzebe, who has been backing and backing away from the whole situation the whole time, getting closer and closer to the goal, is the reason that he deflects it in, because he's in line with the goalkeeper and he's too close to the goalkeeper. All round, it smacked of not just complacency. I wouldn't even call it tiredness. That is just plain and simple not doing your job, not doing what you get paid for. You know, Martial lost the ball higher up the pitch. Matic had run past the ball into Martial. Then for some reason, don't know what his job is, ran beyond Anthony Martial to try and get a second ball. He was crowded out by three players. And everyone, when Manchester United lost the ball, basically walked back, which smacked of, they're not going to score, even if we don't do our job.
That's it. So that's what the complacency is. It's, you think you're going to get away with it. You don't actually have to go that extra 2 yards to close the man down, because even if you throw it in the box, they're not going to score. That was the attitude. That's what that kind of smacked of, and they were wrong.
It's just slightly unfortunate for Solskjaer, and I do slightly feel sorry for him, despite the fact that I've been slagging him off for so long, in that even in this season when they've been doing so well, this is the second or third time where you have some pretty farcical defending that you can attach to his tenure. You know, you had the Istanbul game in the Champions League, every single player up the pitch. You know, we live in this age of little videos on social media or screen grabs of pictures, or, you know, the video of the incident last night was doing the rounds. And that gets attached to to his reign. And it is unfortunate for him, because you don't see that in other top clubs. Like, I can't think of that happening at Leicester.
I think it's about individuals, though. I honestly do. I think that, I know you can be at risk of being cast as a dinosaur or an old football man here, but it's about someone in Manchester United's team not accepting that when they see it. And we've talked about their defence and stuff in the past, and they look at Maguire as a leader. He's not a leader of a team like Manchester United, and I don't see who is. And then, as I say, you can say this is an easy thing to say, but it makes a difference. If you have a centre half who is, or a midfielder, anyone, someone, it's easy again to go back into Manchester United's lineage and pick someone out. But anyone who is a guaranteed kind of 7 or 8 out of 10 every single week, and is just not going to accept that, and is going to pull people around and give them a rocket. I don't think, you know, if that happens after the first mistake, then the second mistake doesn't happen, or someone does close down that extra 2 or 3 yards. So it does matter. That leadership does matter. And I think that was a moment where you saw that they don't really have it still at the kind of most important moments, or when they're low, when they're at their lowest.
I totally agree with you. Last night I watched that game and I was just desperate for a Roy Keane type character to be out on the pitch, who would have been publicly pointing fingers and screaming in faces over people not closing down, over the goalkeeper not putting the ball into the Rose Ed. You know, and that's what you need. Like that is not even talent. That is attitude. And you don't have to be a top player. You don't have to be a top player to have the right attitude. And there were too many players in that situation, at least, who didn't approach the situation with the right attitude.
The truth is that not everyone has that attitude, though. So that's why it's rare. You know, and that's why Manchester United, you're looking across one of the biggest teams in European football, and we're not really seeing someone like that. There's people who step up in moments, like Fernandes or Pogba has recently, but there isn't really someone with that aura. And I still think that is going to be a hindrance for United. You even looked at Maguire's reaction to that, and I'm not having a go at Maguire for this, but he kind of smacked his hand and started to walk off up the pitch. It was like a show of like outrage, but not towards anyone. He didn't dare say it to the people who weren't closing down. He wasn't pulling them up. He just kind of stormed off and looked angry about it. I think in a moment like that, where it was so shambolic, there's nothing wrong with saying, look, that's not good enough.
I completely agree with all of everything you've said. They should have been well ahead already, shouldn't they? I kind of watched that first half, and they should have been well ahead with the amount of chances. And it was interesting because I kind of thought, they're missing Edison Cavani here. That was my thought watching the first half, that they're missing Edison Cavani. And we've spoken about the impact he's had on that team since he's joined. Problem with watching United is that they always seem that one player away from being a Premier League title winner again. I remember Jamie Carragher saying at the beginning of the season, when there was talk of Jadon Sancho, that with Bruno Fernandes now, they're that one player away from being a Premier League title winner. But the problem is a title-winning team doesn't have that sort of mindset. I mean, you look at when City lost all those players to COVID, and they played Chelsea, I think it was beginning of this month, and they just swept them aside, and they were missing so many of their key players. They had De Bruyne playing false nine, which is still a luxury, having De Bruyne in that position, but they adapted and they still managed to do it, whereas United always seem that one player away.
De Bruyne is that kind of player. I remember when City played Real Madrid last season, he tore strips out of Benjamin Mendy in the first half because he kept giving the ball away and he was really sloppy. And you've seen him sometimes coming off the pitch and he's screaming. he looks like a moody git sometimes, but he's someone in your team who raises standards, not just because of the way he performs, but because of what he demands from everyone else around him. So, you know, it's not just like an old school figure of a meathead centre half that's kind of, you know, the old traditional English caricature or that kind of thing. It's just someone who demands the highest standards of those around them.
Tom, it's Arsenal away next at the weekend for Manchester United, then home games with Southampton and Everton in the league before West Ham in the FA Cup. Looking ahead to the game at the Emirates this weekend, will United be the favourites, do you think?
No, not necessarily. I think with Arsenal's momentum, it changes things, doesn't it? I think and yesterday changes things totally. So, you know, Arsenal are a totally different proposition now. And they also have that burden of the record at Old Trafford off their back from earlier in the season, which was before the complete drop in form. And they're a team who have total momentum on their side. You know, Odegaard's joined and brought a... am I saying that right, Hugh? and has brought hopefully will bring an element of creativity there, but they've got it with the kids in Saka and Emil Smith Rowe and Martinelli. And if United play like they did against Sheffield United, then they won't win. They just won't win. They'll be punished. I think at the same time, United won't treat Arsenal in the same way they did last night. As Gregor said, watching them was like, they're not going to score. That was the mindset that seemed to be there. They're not going to score.
Arsenal are unbeaten in 6 Premier League games. They won at Southampton on Tuesday, Tom Clark. Do you think Mikel Arteta is confident going into a game against Manchester United, especially after that win earlier in the season?
I think he can definitely be confident, yeah. It's one of my favourite words on this podcast, talking about narrative, but Arteta has had such a low moment in this season that the attention was pulled off him slightly, and now this, you know, beating Southampton is no easy feat this season. That win almost went a little bit under the radar. There was a kind of, you know, almost... Oh, Arsenal are beating Southampton. That's an impressive result, an impressive performance. So I think he can be very confident because the pressure's completely off him. And I would just say quickly on Manchester United that this game is huge now, because Johnny has been on this podcast talking before about Solskjaer and motivational tactics, and you do feel like they're a momentum team. And you know, I talked before about those one goal wins during the season, and the people were starting to talk about, oh, the Manchester United way, they've done it again, they've got a goal, they found a way to win, etc. It's going to be huge now as to whether this game knocks them off that course, or whether, as Greg has often said, this, you know, cyclical effect of Manchester United, they have the dip, then they come back again, then they have the dip, then they come back again. So this game is huge for Manchester United, and that can only help Arsenal and Mikel Arteta, who... All the signs are good, aren't they? As I say, I really think beating Southampton is not something to be sniffed at.
No, especially after going out of the FA Cup to them and their fans not being very happy. Their fans will be absolutely delighted if they win El Twitterco at the weekend against Manchester United. That's what it's being dubbed on social media, at least. Let's move not far across London to big rivals of Arsenal, let's call them that. Chelsea, they've got a new manager. Yeah, that's right. Arteta outlasted Frank Lampard. Thomas Tuchel in the dugout for them now at Stamford Bridge. For the first time on Wednesday, as Chelsea and Wolves played out a goalless draw. Now, Chelsea looked a different side. We'll talk tactics in a moment. But first, Thomas Tuchel took a bit of a sledgehammer to some of Chelsea's youngsters. Mason Mount, who was captain under Lampard at the weekend in the FA Cup, was benched, as was Reece James and Tammy Abraham. Young Scott Billy Gilmore wasn't even in the squad. Tom Roddy, you've written about this change at Chelsea in the game this week. Is it going to be a bit of a culture shock for those Chelsea players under Thomas Tuchel?
Yeah, it will. It will. I mean, you said about speaking about tactics later, but there, I think that will be a big thing which will change there. I mean, everything we hear about Tuchel is what, you know, he's almost like the second coming of Wenger in a way, with this obsession with football and this adaptability in tactics, which interests me a little bit last night. You know, they take on a Wolves side who play three at the back, and Chelsea play three at the back. He decides to play three at the back. But it will be a big culture shock. I mean, one of the things coming out of Chelsea about the decision of picking Tuchel was this idea that part of his reputation is developing young players. The understandable but possibly lazy look on the appointment was Thomas Tuchel's German, Chelsea want Kai Havertz and Timo Werner to start going, you know, the German lads at Chelsea, and this is the guy they get in. And it's understandable because they also looked at Ralf Rangnick and also Julian Nagelsmann. But at the same time, he's worked with Thiago Silva and he's also worked with Christian Pulisic. But last night was a big indication of where he's going to go. It's difficult to read too much into it, but it's that typical trick that a lot of managers do when they replace someone. They bring in the disaffected players and they're given an opportunity. We saw Mount had played the last 10 games under Lampard, and he comes on and he does change the game. But it's going to affect their kids. I mean, I think Billy Gilmore is almost certainly going to go out on loan now.
It's going to be an interesting one with him, the young Scott Billy Gilmore, Gregor. I know you'd like to see him play a bit of football. I was tweeting last night, I'd like Ed Woodward to put a bid in for him. He's got a massive future. Maybe I'm putting too much pressure on him, though. We'll talk about some young stars a little bit later on. But, Tom Clark, it does feel like that class of 19, if you like, looks at risk of being broken up over the next couple of years at Chelsea already. Do you think Chelsea fans would accept it if the likes of Abraham are pushed out and Reece James?
I don't necessarily agree that it is the end of that particular class of, you know, that group of players. I think the thing Tuchel wants to do first is get his system and his tactics in place. And that was the thing that a lot of people, myself included, were most critical of Frank Lampard for, was that you watched Chelsea and you weren't sure what they were about tactically on the pitch. The system changed all the time. And fine, it was a 0-0 draw. There was some, I thought, strange punditry on Match of the Day last night talking about, oh, it was, this is not how Chelsea want to play. And you're like, well, hang on a minute, he's only just arrived. We don't know how Chelsea want to play yet because Tuchel's only just got here. What struck me was that he picked a system and a team and players that fit that system. And it made sense. You know, I looked at it and I watched it and I thought, okay, I get it. Yeah. Wing backs, experienced back three, holding midfielders, place for Kai Havertz to find space in the pockets, you know, in a forward area. That's fine. It makes sense. But I don't necessarily think that we should write off that whole group of young players yet.
I'm not saying write them off, but what I'm saying is it was clear that Frank Lampard had put a lot of faith in those young English players, and it was clear he was going to lean towards them. And it becomes apparent that Thomas Tuchel isn't the sort of manager who's going to have any favourites, really. And I think that may be an allegation that was put towards Lampard.
Yeah, I think so. And that obviously became part of Lampard's tenure, and a big selling point was that he was giving these kids a chance. But as we alluded to on the previous show, part of the reason for him giving those kids a chance was that when he took over, there was a transfer ban. And so it was easy for him to develop that narrative as the guy who gives Tammy Abraham a chance because he couldn't sign a striker. So I genuinely think, as Tom says, Tuchel's got a good record with young players. If Reece James and Tammy Abraham are good enough for his system and for his team, that I think they'll play. And I think ultimately, to go back to your earlier question, it comes back to my favourite point about football, which is that it's about winning games. And so, and nowhere is that more important or apparent than at Chelsea, particularly when they've spent all that money. And so if he gets a team, you know, that has both Kai Havertz and Thiago Silva and Jorginho and Kante playing well and winning, then if Billy Gilmore falls by the wayside, they'll accept it.
I think the whole, it's something that Tuchel probably, you know, he wants to get a good start, because I agree, I don't think he's, you know, this spells the end for these young kids, these Chelsea kids, as they're so often described, despite the fact that, as reading, Havertz and Pulisic are younger than Mount and Abraham. So because they're not through the academy, we sort of discount that, or perhaps because they're foreign. But this is the discussion already, after 90 minutes of football and one team selection. That's the discussion. And then there's also the whole thing about, I think, you know, the people had such a strange relationship with Frank. You know, most of the pundits were his best friend.
Or his cousin.
Swathes of the media are kind of, I think even though a lot of people deep down were aware that he's not really qualified for the job, I think a lot of people wanted him to be a success. And now that he's gone, you know, I think Tuchel's probably not going to get that much leeway. It's like this guy who's the sort of arch intellect from, you know, kind of professorial kind of character. They want to see the proof of that on the pitch. And what they definitely don't want to see is any kind of semblance of Sarri ball as well.
The one thing I would say as well is that, you know, Tuchel, last night he was saying, this is the most unfair lineup I've ever named because I joined last night and took a training session and I'm in the dugout 24 hours later, which, yeah, that's fair enough. But Tuchel was approached for this job almost a month ago. He is this kind of obsessive of football. He'll have watched all the games that Chelsea have played recently. He'll have watched back all the games. He'll know the potential of Billy Gilmore. He'll know the potential of Tammy Abraham. He'll know the potential of Christian Pulisic. So you know, you get to see and understand a player more on the training pitch and one-to-one, but we can still take indications from that team selection.
Mason Mount is good enough. I mean, he should be in that team, no matter who they are, where they're from, how much they cost. He's proved this season. He's probably been Chelsea's best player this season. So I would back him to whoever's in charge to show that. And I would probably say the same of Reece James, although there is some issues about his defending sometimes. But brilliant player, yeah. So I think they, Abraham, you know, when you're a striker at Chelsea, you're always going to have some pretty steep competition, so he'll have a difficult task perhaps, but I would certainly not say that these guys are going to be discounted, and they're good enough to be in the team, so it's up to him to show it.
I've got to say, I think Tom Roddy, you're right as well in terms of Tuchel knowing what he was going to play, because that was not the formation or the approach of a manager who hadn't had things planned for quite some time. He didn't jot that on the back of a cigarette packet after that training session. Chelsea had 78.9% possession. That is the most by a new manager in their first game in the past 17 years in the Premier League. We mentioned the wing-backs, Chilwell, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Kovacic and Jorginho in central midfield. Kai Havertz got 90 minutes as well, unbelievably. But Chelsea only created 5 shots on target for all of that joy. There was a lack of, I guess, incisive football. They played a little bit too safely. And that will come over time, I think. Are we going to get used to seeing, Tom Clark, do you think? Are we going to get used to seeing this formation in every game for Chelsea?
I'm not sure. And I'm as a bit of a tactical geek, I'm quite excited about it because I think Tuchel might be someone who will use this for a month. And then perhaps once he's seen the, you know, some of the other players in training, might switch it up again. But as Tom said, he's clearly someone who's absolutely obsessed with football and his systems and his formations. So I think we're going to see some really interesting things from him. But I, maybe this is partly to do with the, you know, everyone loving Frank and quite keen to pour a little bit of scorn on Tuchel. But, you know, last night he said something about, I think he said something about 16 recoveries in the final third of the pitch. And people were saying, oh, well done, that's just what you want. But that is just what you want.
Hold on a minute. You said that football was not an entertainment business, it was a results business, and now you're saying 16 recoveries is better than scoring one goal.
No, let me finish for a start, having spent 20 minutes talking about Anthony Martial not tracking back or defending. Anyway, that's a good point in modern football. And so if Tuchel is going to start with 16 recoveries in the final third and loads of possession and 90 minutes for Kai Havertz, he will start with that and build from there. And maybe the formation will adapt, but he's going to get those, you know, foundations in place first. And I think, you know, being disparaging about loads of possession but no shots, it's his first game. Like, you know, let's give the guy a chance. I'm excited to see what he can do. Because I think, you know, you just said it there as well. Callum Hudson-Odoi is someone that Lampard didn't play that often and is someone that Chelsea were desperate to keep out of Bayern Munich's clutches. And he gets a chance. And there was a great moment talking about effort and tracking back where I think Hudson-Odoi sprinted half the length of the pitch to stop, was it Dendonka for Wolves getting in at the back post and cleared the ball. So I think it's going to be really interesting. And I think 16 recoveries in the final third, whether you like anti-football or attractive football, is a good start for me.
Hudson-Odoi was brilliant and played for parts of the match at both right and left wing back, showing his versatility as well. And talking about effort, he certainly did put it in and was man of the match for both the broadcasters, I think, and us radio guys as well. Chelsea face Burnley at the weekend in the Premier League. We'll discuss Sean Dyche's side next on the Game podcast. But you can read Henry Winter right now in the Times claiming the clock is already ticking for Thomas Tuchel after a limp opener. That's in the Times right now. Remember, you can get more of our award-winning journalism subscribing to the Times and the Sunday Times across all of your devices. Sign up today and you'll get yourself 1 month free. Just search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Up next on the Game podcast, well, I've got to say, I think Aston Villa were marginally the better side at Turf Moor for me. But it doesn't really matter to Sean Dyche's Burnley. They burst the Villa bubble with a 3-2 win. An exciting game, to be perfectly honest. It was the first time Burnley have scored three goals in the Premier League since February the 22nd of last year. Burnley coming from behind twice. They are now 9 points above the relegation zone. And once again, Tom Clark, defying expectations.
I just love them. They're just great. In the modern, you know, in modern football with managers changing all the time, in this strange and crazy world we live in, Sean Dyche's Burnley are just a reliable, you know, modicum of consistency that we can all rely on. You're right, it was a fantastic game. And were it not for the shock upset at Old Trafford, I think it would probably have been the first time Burnley had been first on Match of the Day. It was great to see. Villa, as you say, deserve a lot of credit because they were brilliant as well. I mean, Jack Grealish nearly scored one of the goals of the, you know, decade with that run down the left wing and then the shot in the second half. But I just think Sean Dyche deserves so much credit because every season there seems to be a bit of discussion around, oh, well, this will be the season Burnley go down. And they might still go down this season. But it's the fact that they book that trend all the time. They seem to do it even if they lose players. You know, Eric Peters has come in at left back for the last few games ahead of Charlie Taylor. Charlie Taylor's probably one of their best players, most important players, overlapping at left back, getting crosses into the box. You know, Eric Peters signed from Stoke. People are like, oh, why are you signing Eric Peters? He's been brilliant at left back. I've said what a big fan I am of Tarkowski and me in central defence. But they have got good creative players as well. Ashley Westwood in midfield. Dwight McNeil is a fantastic player, young player as well. And someone who I think will probably benefit greatly later on in his career from having been in a Dyche Burnley team. And I just think they're a great contrast in modern football to a lot of the other teams that we see. And the way they play produces great games like last night. Games for people like you, Hugh, the people who want entertainment, want end-to-end. They help produce that because they're overlapping, whipping crosses into the box, and Villa are trying to pass it around them and score fantastic goals. Because the goal Grealish did score was also a brilliant goal, brilliant passing and moving goal, which is how you need to play to get past Burnley. You need to zip it about quick, and you need to, you know, get players in the box to try and get past their stoic and stubborn defence. They're brilliant. The longer they stay in the Premier League, the more entertainment people like you will be able to enjoy, Hugh, I'm sure.
No, listen, I love teams like Chris Wilder's Sheffield United. I love teams like Sean Dyche's Burnley, because that's part of, I think that is part of our game in terms of application. And that is why people say, oh, it's the toughest league in the world, because we have teams who go out there, and even if they are perceived as not having the quality of other sides, you know, the teams at the bottom of our leagues are working their socks off every single game, and they're very well coached and organised, and they play a massive part in the quality of the game in this country. So nothing against sides like Burnley, and fully love watching their games. I can't believe that you're implying that I don't. It's also the sort of game I think that Sean Dyche loves to win, so that he can go into his press conference afterwards and say, well, they spent 200 million quid, and in his words, we've spent a bag of chips. Now, that might be a message to the new owners, Gregor. I don't know. What do you think about the fact that they haven't spent that much money, they continue to produce? Because I think, in a way, it helps the stability of the team. And that's what I wanted to highlight. You know, the fact that you don't have loads of money means that you don't have the squad changing so much. And if the squad doesn't change so much, the players get to know one another, you build that team spirit, and everyone knows their jobs. And I just wondered if you thought that that consistency helps. You know, the manager's been there a long time too.
Absolutely. And Dyche said that after the game, in fact. He said one benefit of having been here so long and worked with the players so long is that I know what they're about. And I knew that, you know, I would get a reaction in the second half if I kind of made it clear that we needed one. And I'm sure he did. Because, let's be honest, I'm not sure how Villa didn't win this game. The amount of chances, and they were superb in the first half. But they did get that reaction. And as you say, it's kind of, they were just far more on the front foot. You know, in the first half, it was like they were camped in their own box. And Grealish is so hard to play against because so many players get drawn to him, and it creates space for others. That's how Target was kind of slotted in the left, and the cross came in for the first goal. And really, that's what happened for his goal too. Everyone was drawn to him. He played a 1-2, and that was a goal. So I think, but the main thing they did was they were just far more on the front foot, far more aggressive, and that's what we kind of recognise as Burnley. And they just kept chucking crosses in the box as well. And that, what a header it was as well.
Two headers. Wood's header is amazing as well. Mee's header as well. That was such a classic. When you watched it, he seemed to be coming in the air for about 10 seconds. It was like slow-mo. You could see him coming from the edge of the box.
Michael Jordan scoring headers at Turf Moor.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
They've got some good routines as well, Burnley. Remember they did one, I can't remember what it was, a few weeks back, where they kind of double-teamed. It's like Tarkowski kind of is almost the man that Mee jumps over and leans on. It's like their tag team. But Wood's header was just remarkable. It was, you know, he was running backwards away from goal, and he must have been, 12 yards out or something as well, and just kind of directed it into the corner with just enough power to get past Martinez. And yeah, I mean, as I say, I think Villa have been, a game that Villa is playing in is a game you like to watch as well, because they really are very entertaining. They've got so much creativity, and as I say, in the first half they should have really been out of sight, as Dean Smith said, but as Dyche said, he knows that he can get a reaction from his players, and they certainly did get that in the second half. And there's no chance Burnley are going down. I think, you know, Tommy's saying that may happen this season. They're too effective, and they're undoubtedly going to be 5 or 6 teams worse than them in the Premier League this season.
There's still a question mark, though, over the manager's future, not because of what he's producing at the moment, but because we didn't really talk about it on the podcast. There was a takeover at Burnley in December, the American investment group ALK Capital. The new owner, has promised a unique approach, which might be by spending no money, which would be a pretty unique approach in the Premier League. Who knows? But Tom Roddy, do you think if they're one of those types of owners that have lofty ambitions, that despite it maybe coming across as a bit insane, they might move away from Sean Dyche?
Not in the short term, no. And I mean, it would be absolute madness to do that, because he is one of the real miracle workers of the Premier League. I mean, you mentioned that quote, Hugh, about spending a bag of chips and in the summer, and that Sean Dyche does like to compare how much his team has spent compared to other teams. But it's true. It is inescapably true. I mean, I think, was it Dale Stevens was their biggest buy of the summer from Brighton, and that was £1.5 million. And he'd come to Brighton. He wasn't a first team player in Brighton. He'd gone to Brighton from Charlton Athletic when they were in League One. I mean, this isn't a criticism of Dale Stevens. It's just context around a Sean Dyche, what Sean Dyche has got to work with, and what the thing is what he gets out of a team. Because I thought that moment, and I don't want to talk about Man United again, but that moment that Tom and Gregor spoke about with Man United's defending, I watched that and thought, That will never ever happen at Burnley. That will never happen in a Sean Dyche team. Anthony Martial doesn't get into a Sean Dyche team. Paul Pogba probably doesn't get into a Sean Dyche team. And that this is nothing to do with Man United. It's just to do with that moment and the way in which Burnley and Sean Dyche play and what their ethos is.
Burnley are quite unique, though, in that. Even, you know, they might have allowed they might have allowed the cross in, but my God, they would have got a block on. You wouldn't have seen Twan Zebe kind of standing in the 6-yard box. They could consistently have the most blocks of any team in the Premier League. They're quite unique in that they know they can defend crosses, they know they can defend their kind of 6-12 yard box, that area just in front of the goal. They can defend that for their lives, and that a lot of that is because of me and Tarkowski. But the thing that will also be interesting after the takeover is the direction of the recruitment. You know, I think they're quite heavily into analytics, and be interested. You know, there's a very British kind of foundation to Sean Dyche's team, and you'll look. You know, Josh Brownhill's another one. Although he's £9 million, that's still in Premier League terms, peanuts. He's from Bristol City. He took a while to get in the team. Now he's an absolute fixture in midfield alongside Ashley Westwood. Another kind of typical example of picking a player who's one of the best in the Championship. So whether he's kind of afforded to do that a little bit more or slightly raise the ceiling of the value of these players will be interesting. But if it's a case of casting the net wider, you know, that's something that can potentially change the ethos of the team and the makeup and the dynamic. So that will be interesting going forward to see how much sway Sean Dyche still holds over, you know, the direction of like how they aim to progress, basically.
Interesting to see, having scored only 9 goals before last night, that's now up to 12 all season. They've been bidding for Stoke City defender Nathan Collins. They need a central defender, clearly, at Burnley, which of course pretty much sums up Sean Dyche's approach to recruitment, but it clearly does work. Tom Roddy, Chelsea versus Burnley at the weekend. Maybe a Burnley 1-0 is probably the most predictable scoreline, is it?
I remember, Hugh, it was this time last week, I was on the podcast and saying that Frank Lampard had Luton, Wolves and Burnley 3 winnable games to turn around the momentum. Now you're looking at Thomas Tuchel having a bit of an underwhelming draw last night and going to Burnley and having a real shock of experiencing English football. This is going to be really hard for them.
Tom Clark, what do you think?
It'll be very difficult, but as we said with the Tuchel analysis earlier, we don't quite know what he is about just yet. And I wouldn't be surprised if someone that is as obsessed and as focused on planning, as Tom alluded to earlier, whether he has a completely different plan in store for Burnley. Maybe he's going to use his first 3 games, try a couple of different systems and formations and see what works. But it'll be incredibly difficult. But one thing, just to go back to the recruitment, it's interesting how our conversation is all couched in the idea that the Burnley way and Sean Dyche, it has to be cheaper, you know, British players maybe. And whether it'll be fascinating to see whether they can keep Sean Dyche, keep the Burnley way, and maybe spend £15 million on a right back. Because there's no reason you can't buy a fullback who works really hard and his crosses are slightly better than the one you've got already. and still fit that idea. It'll be interesting to see whether they go down that route or whether Dyche resists it. But yeah, to go back to your question, it'll be a very difficult game. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Tuchel throw a completely different formation system and selection at Burnley.
Gregor, you were grinning a second ago. Was it a ridiculous question?
No. I was just thinking more about... I'm not saying that Sean Dyche is going to resist kind of casting the net wider. It's just that's the kind of conditions under which he's worked for so long. It's actually similar to Chris Wilder. This kind of thing was... he's always come up from lower leagues in England, and that's where the players he knows. And then they've tried to kind of broaden their horizon a bit this year, and the recruitment hasn't really worked. So it's a difficult transition that, you know, you know one way, and Sean Dyche is an intelligent enough guy to change that, or to change it gradually. But it's just going to be interesting to see how much control he has over that, I think. But looking forward to this weekend. I mean, yeah, Tuchel, welcome to the, you know, everyone thinks the Premier League's this kind of mad intensity, and he's going to be, his first two games, our team's basically sitting on their own 6-yard box, trying to come and break us down and have 90% of the ball. And good luck if you can break them down again.
Yeah, slight difference to Liga. I think it's a little bit more difficult to break down those teams, certainly at the bottom of the table. But Sean Dyche versus Thomas Tuchel is going to be interesting, both the pre and post-match press conferences and interviews as well from those two characters. Looking forward to another big game in the Premier League. Of course, it's a big game to start the Arsenal career of Martin Odegaard, if you like. Listen, it's not just me. I'll play you what he himself says, and you'll get an indication as to the pronunciation. Have a listen.
Hi, my name is Martin Odegaard, but you can call me Martin Odegaard.
Very difficult. Look, he's smiling, he's happy, he's delighted to be in the Premier League and in London. He's arrived, the 22-year-old Norwegian, at Norway International, no less, on loan from Real Madrid. It's his fourth loan, though, since signing for Real Madrid as a 15-year-old starlet, a wonder kid, and annoyingly, already in Mikel Arteta's press conference, he's been asked about Martin Ødegaard in reference to him being compared to the next Messi, which of course shows you the sort of expectation that young wonder kids have been put under. He's 22 years old now. He's clearly not the next Messi, yet the questions still come in. And Mikel Arteta said, "I wouldn't even suggest anyone could get close to Messi because it's a lost battle, in my opinion. But Martin is Martin. I think the last few seasons he's progressed and developed in the right way. I followed him very closely because he played for Real Sociedad, which is my hometown. I know him really well. I've been really impressed. He is such a talent. He just needs the right environment and a little bit of more time, but I think he has the qualities to be a success for us." And now there is a lot of pressure and expectation at Arsenal generally for new signings, but of course someone whose name has floated around world and European football as being the next big thing for such a long time will have extra pressure on him, particularly as he's hit this point in his career where he is starting to play quite well. But in many ways it's a difficult position for any player to be in, where your career is more potential and expectation than it is substance. Because, of course, people are waiting for you to fulfill what they think you should be. Tom Clark, maybe you should start us off on this, because there are a raft of players we could discuss as having been through this sort of experience.
There certainly are. We were thinking about this topic before the show and talking about Ødegaard. I'm going to go with his second pronunciation, as he's given me the choice. I'm going to go with his second one. What a lovely bloke he sounds like, by the way. Such a friendly guy. What struck me, I was looking at players similar to Ødegaard who kind of burst onto the scene very young, and you realise how many of them, you know, we can name and think about who didn't, as you say, make it as they were supposed to. Theo Walcott is for me a classic example of someone who was not ruined by the start of his career, but he was picked for a World Cup having barely played a minute as this, you know, prodigal super quick forward, and, you know, then went to Arsenal, had a pretty successful career at Arsenal as an Arsenal player playing at the top level, and yet there were always these questions about him. What is he? Is he a striker? Is he a winger? Is he good enough? Has he fulfilled his potential? And it was all couched in the fact that he reached, you know, was picked for the England team by Sven-Goran Eriksson to go to a World Cup and never played. And there's a raft of them, and I just found it fascinating. And it actually made me, looking through them, appreciate players like Wayne Rooney even more. Because I was discussing this with a group of friends, and one of them said that whoever, I forget who the commentator was, but when he scored that goal against Arsenal, remember the name Wayne Rooney. How often a commentator might have said, remember the name, and inserted the name of someone who happened to have scored a goal age 17, and then no one remembers the name because he never did anything. And so the fact to burst onto the scene as any young player is great and impressive. To sustain the career you're then expected to have is seriously, seriously impressive. And I just hope with Ødegaard, Arsenal fans don't, they just allow him to be, and they obviously won't, I'm being a dreamer, but, you know, allow him to see, to be the player he is now, not the player people thought he was going to be when he was 15.
I think Clive Tyldesley was the man that shouted the words, remember the name Wayne Rooney. But when Rooney retired recently from football, I think it was something that I mentioned, that there are very few players who live up to all of the expectation. You know, all the things that were said about him when he burst onto the scene. He's going to be a future England captain. You know, he should be playing for the likes of Manchester United. When he got there, he's going to be a future record goal scorer for both England and Manchester United. And he ticked off every single box. And by the way, with a lot of scrutiny, with a lot of pressure, you know, every single thing he did, even remotely out of place in his career, was magnified massively. And I think he was still towards the latter end of that. That era of media scrutiny that the likes of Beckham had felt during their careers as well. I think it's slightly changed now with social media and players being able to shape the narrative around themselves a little bit more. But I think that was a huge portion of Rooney's career. And there are so many. Jack Wilshere scored in the FA Cup at the weekend, you know, for Bournemouth. And I think people will see his career as being very flat and a failure, because he was meant to be the next great thing for Arsenal. He had the number 10 shirt there. You know, he was meant to be the one playing for England and winning trophies. And you know, I find it difficult because, look, we see a young player burst onto the scene. We do put a lot of expectation on them. Clearly, there are a lot of great young talents that come out of this country, especially. But there are huge factors around whether players can make a success of themselves. And I think Mikel Arteta's right. It is about environment. Gregor, the environment of a football club for a young player, what is that like? Because there are so many players talk about the daunting experience. They talk about the players who don't make a club welcome, who don't want a young player to take their place. You know, all these things that can affect, you know, a player who maybe left school when he was 14 or 15 years old to join an academy.
I mean, there are so many factors and that decide whether a player is going to kind of fulfill a potential. And a lot of them are, as you say, external. It could be changes in manager. It could be, you know, being afforded the opportunities that you thought you were going to get at the outset. But when you're talking about players of this level and this kind of talent, then I don't know. I think generally it's down to them. I think it's down to their kind of confidence, their development. That period between kind of 16 and 20 is probably the most important period in a footballer's career. And I've played with and against a few players in this kind of category. I remember playing against Freddie Adu for DC United once on a pre-season tour with Nottingham Forest. And he was a huge name, and he probably would have been 14 or 15 or something at that time. I was looking back, I think that was 2004, and he's still only 31. Like, and, you know, a few years later, he was in his early 20s, and he was already thought of as a flop. Like, just didn't, you know, he was so young, and he didn't develop in the way that was forecast. It's kind of, and as I say, part of that's to do with, it can be to do with the development of your body, can do to do with dealing with coping with the scrutiny and the pressure and things like that, the psychological aspect of it. So there are so many things go into it, but The other one that kind of was, that I always remember, I played against Wayne Rooney in the FA Youth Cup. So that was a few months before he scored that goal. We played against Everton, and he was just astonishing. Like, this force of nature, 16, and you thought, I mean, wow. He just rattled the crossbar a few times. He scored a bicycle kick. He was a joke. And after the game, our manager was John Pemberton. He said, he's the next Alan Shearer. I remember him saying that vividly. And then what was also interesting, and I remember him saying, was that he picked our best player. It was a guy called Craig Westcar, who played with Rooney in England teams, who went on to be Forest's youngest ever player at 16. And he said to Westy, he said, "Do you think Rooney's better than you?" And the fact that he was asking that question tells you how highly everyone thought of Greg Westcar. And in the next few years, their careers just went in completely different directions. Rooney obviously scored that goal, playing for Man United. Westy stayed at Forest he played a good number of games, but never really held down a place. And I played with him at Chesterfield later in our careers. He played for Notts County, he played in the lower leagues. But at that age, at that moment in time, he was almost thought of on the same level as Rooney. And there are so many reasons for that, for those different paths. And as I say, part of it is dealing with the pressure, and part of it is it's kind of keeping the hunger. I think once you get something so young, it's maintaining your hunger and your kind of desire to keep improving, I think, in that period from about 16 to 20. Because if you don't do that in that period, then you can lose a lot of what you were expecting you were going to get.
Tom Roddy, can you think of some young starlets who, I don't know, who went either way, you know, great successes and made the best of it, or just couldn't deliver to what the fans and the managers that had taught them up had expected?
Yeah. I just wanted to note, though, as well, that as Gregor said, it's that idea of the next is such a weight on young players' shoulders, isn't it? I mean, the idea of Rooney, Gregor's manager, saying the next Alan Shearer. We hear that almost monthly when a player breaks onto the scene. I mean, even I was writing about Emil Smith Rowe last week, and he's been nicknamed the Croydon De Bruyne, and I wasn't calling him that, but that is a big pressure and expectation to fulfil. And I think even just thinking of examples, so many players are called the next Messi now, aren't they? And Bojan, years ago, was the next Messi. He broke onto the scene at Barcelona, and I think he scored 10 goals in his first season. And it wasn't so long ago he was at Stoke. Someone who followed a similar path to Odegaard, the beginning of the story was Royston Drenthe, who was did the same thing in his native Holland, moved to Real Madrid as a young kid. It didn't work out, and I remember watching him play at the Medeski for Reading in the Championship, and he wasn't doing it there either. And these are really sad stories about a lack of potential, and they're all different. Not a lack of potential, sorry, a lack of fulfilling that potential, and they're different stories as well, because you know the one that really stands out as a sad one is the guy before who filled the boots before Phil Foden, Michael Johnson at Manchester City. And of course, speaking about the way in which Rooney, you know, the amount of pressure that was on Rooney's shoulders, Michael Johnson was called the next best thing by Sven-Göran Eriksson.
Yeah, he was City. Called the next Steven Gerrard, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was the guy coming through. And of course, I think he was 24 when he retired, and it was because of the way in which his City career sort of fell off a cliff and he ended up falling into depression. And he said that I didn't have the skill set to handle all of that expectation and pressure. And they are sad stories.
He was a fantastic young player, really sad story from a football and personal perspective for him, and I hope he's well. There are so many next, though. I mean, Phil Foden's the Stockport Iniesta now, isn't he? I think that's what he's called. And you wonder if his career, you know, I say peters out, if he ends up being a Premier League player for his whole career, but not winning loads of trophies and Champions Leagues, etc., people will say he hasn't fulfilled his potential, you know, even if he has a top level career for his whole career. Funnily enough, I spoke to Armand Traore, who came through at Arsenal recently, who spoke about the pressures of the job and never really being able to cope with it. Of course, he went to Juventus on loan. He was at Portsmouth and QPR. And again, and you hear this a lot from former players, you know, they often say to you, particularly off air, that they never really did anything in football. and it's a really sad thing to hear. And you're sitting there saying, kids dream of this, dream of even playing, you know, pulling on a QPR shirt or pulling on a Portsmouth shirt once. You know, what you've achieved in football, to play for Arsenal, to play for Juventus, to play for these clubs in the Premier League, to have a 10-year career in the top flight and to play in the Championship as well, is definitely making it, you know. But the thing is, and I think what he explained back to me is, you are taken into the mindset of you are going to be a superstar, and that's drilled into you. You know, he spoke about coming through the teams in France, the young under 16 teams they had in France. And then, I mean, it's just brilliant, brilliant players, many of whom have had massive careers. And he said, you're put into the mindset of having a top level career and winning World Cups with France, to the point that anything less then feels like a failure. And I wonder whether we just need to be a bit more measured with particularly the players who are at top clubs. Tom Clark.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. It's that's what struck me. It's either, when researching this before, it's the extremes of the two. You have either the Wayne Rooney stories, or you have the Michael Johnson's very incredibly sad stories. It's the middle ground that I would like to find a little bit more of. Is, if you're talking about bursting onto the scene for a big club, Federico Maceda as a 17-year-old coming on for Manchester United and doing a Cruyff turn and curling one into the top corner is about as good as it gets. I think he then scored the winner in the next game as well. But he then went on and played loan spells at Cardiff and QPR. And I think he's now at Panathinaikos in Greece, but still playing football. And it's that kind of middle ground. And James Milner is another good example, a more successful example of a middle ground before anyone starts. He's obviously a fantastic player. But when he came onto the scene, I can remember people, I think he was just after Rooney, I think, from memory, came on the scene at Leeds, and people thought he was an attacking midfielder, attacking winger. I think he scored early on in his career. And again, he's a good example of career changed, maybe didn't push through early as Rooney. Newcastle career, Aston Villa, but has been a Premier League winner with Manchester City and with Liverpool. So
Champions League winner. I mean, he's done it all.
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting hearing Gregor talk about coaching, because he also talked about mentality. But that's going to be a big thing for Arteta with Odegaard, and it's got to be a massive thing, hasn't it? With how, and we mentioned Phil Foden, I mentioned it on Monday's show, Pep has been asked about him over and over again and has sheltered him and, you know, coached him through to this point where he's now allowing him to shine. Coaching has to play a massive part in these players' development, don't they? When they burst onto that scene, do you hold them back? Do you let them go in the way that Rooney was just unleashed? You know, even when he signed for Manchester United, you know, there was no real... Ferguson wasn't hiding him. Sven wasn't hiding him for England. It was such a unique case. Coaching has to play a massive part as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, just quickly going back to the thing you're saying about the expectations almost placed on players, I think players do that themselves as well. You know, any kid growing up, they don't dream... Well, let's be brutally honest. If you're a good player growing up, you don't dream of playing for Chesterfield, who I played for.
I was wondering whether he'd say a club that he actually played for or another club. He stayed safe and went for a club he played for.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, they don't dream of playing for Nottingham Forest in the Championship either. You dream of playing at the very, very top. You do. And you know, there'll come a point where you realise what your ceiling might be and though your expectations start to be changed. But if you're a player of extreme talent, you dream of playing at the top. And so it's not just about other people placing that expectation on you. It's about you doing it. So another thing to say is that I would say probably 90%, maybe more, of football careers end in... with regret. So we're talking about Wayne Rooney, and he's looking around, and yes, he's all these things he's achieved, but there still is a conversation somewhere from people saying that, has he really fulfilled his potential? Unless you are the real elite, or you're someone who's really, really level-headed about and kind of sanguine about looking back at your football career, almost everyone has a regret because they think they could have done something differently. You know, if they'd won promotion there, they might have played in the Premier League. Or if you played for Liverpool, crikey, look at Steven Gerrard or Carragher and all them. They won loads of silverware, they never won the Premier League title. Even the very best players, I would suggest, if I've been totally honest, will be filled with regrets at the end of their career. No one, very, very rarely does someone look back and think, I'm happy with that.
But does it tend to be then specific regrets? I mean, for you personally, do you have specific regrets about, that time I had a trial, or that time I had a run of games for Forest and, you know, it didn't quite work out? Or are they more general regrets when you're doing the washing up and thinking, balls, you know, could I have done a bit more? You know, you gave, you know, vague examples there. Are your regrets specific to certain moments, or are they vague ones?
You can hone in specific regrets. I mean, I remember... I don't know if I really... I remember being offered a 3.5-year contract at Forest when I was in the team, and then the manager got sacked, and, you know, I hadn't signed it, and I was released at the end of the year. So I could have had an opportunity to be at a big club like Forest for three more years, essentially. And, you know, and then you're in that environment and you have the opportunity to play there for longer. Or if I watch football now and I see, or if I'm at a game and I see the real kind of those special moments or like promotions and things like that, you think, you know, I won promotion twice. There are other moments in my career where I feel like we should have won promotion, or, you know, you see players who you know for 100% have fulfilled they look like they've fulfilled their potential. They've, you know, they're absolutely dedicated. There's life choices as well you make. Actually, things away from football, you think that probably wasn't good for my career. And that's another thing that's probably diminishing a little bit now, because football is more professional than in my day. But there's other things away from football that you realise probably affected how your career went. So there are lots of things that you can regret in a career, I think. And I would suggest, as I say, that most footballers look back on their career and think, I could have done more. Or it might not always have been their fault. It may have just been the circumstance or a team they were playing in, or they didn't get that move because the club wouldn't come up and pay that extra £1 million for them or something like that, and then that team went on and won the FA Cup or something. You know, there's always things. Some of it's just circumstances, but I think very few careers end and the footballer's really happy with how it's gone, to be honest.
The thing is, you mentioned, Hugh, about the environment of a club being important, and Gregor mentioned about the mentality of a player, and they are hugely important. But also nowadays, or even in the last, you know, 20 years and maybe before that, a lot of it is about the surroundings specifically around a player, the people that they have around them. Because I do quite a few of these sort of profile-y background stories, and sometimes I speak to family members or the agents who represent them, and they don't really want to do it, and they'd rather you did it next year maybe or something like that. And it surprises me at first, because you think of the coverage, you'd expect them to want the coverage, but part of it is the expectation that piece may put on them. You know, they expect them to be a big footballer. They expect them to succeed in a great career, but they just want that bit more time for them to develop. And we've seen it a little bit over the last, 2 years, with specifically Jude Bellingham. He was 16 years old at Birmingham, and there was so much talk around him and Man United. He's probably the one right now in terms of a young player who we expect so much from, and so much pressure is being put on him already. And that's, I wonder and think that is part of the reason why Dortmund worked for them, because it's out of the limelight from the English, British press, media, fans. So you can make those mistakes that you're bound to make, and you see the highlights reel that we used to see of Jadon Sancho, and then you can come back here once you've got that belief and developed into the player you can become.
Interesting choice from Jude Bellingham and his family, and that's a big factor as well, taking the decision to go to Borussia Dortmund. And of course, we as England fans hope, sorry Gregor, that he does great things in the future.
I do too. Yeah, EFL graduate, absolutely.
Exactly. Showing that great talent does come out of the Football League. Gregor, by the way, don't think too much. Don't get inside your own head too much. It's plenty of...
I'm just looking off wistfully out the window now.
Exactly.
The wind in the trees.
Well, don't worry, Gregor, don't worry. There are plenty of great things for you to look forward to over the next year or so. And of course, you're the Times Iniesta, mate. We'll call you that. You continue to do great things for us. Thank you to Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark. Remember, you can get more of our award-winning journalism across all of your devices right now. Get yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. Sign up today and you'll get yourself 1 month free. Just search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. We will see you on Monday.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.